The first question of the night came from Teokusin Ghost Horse concerning Leonard Peltier. We'll turn that first to Ramsey, and then we have quite a number of other questions. There's no way that Ramsey's going to answer 100 questions here tonight, so we're going to try to sort through this a little bit here.
I may not answer any, but I'll say something anyway. There are two reasons that the United States has been so egregiously unjust toward Leonard Peltier. The first one is one we need to think about. It's pathetic. It's the idea that somehow or other a cop's life is worth more than anybody else's. I remember one time in the mid-60s, I was in a federal prison called Segalville, Texas. It was hot as blazes. I was deputy attorney general, and the warden was escorting me around, and there was an old man sitting by a building in the broiling sun. And I thought, my God, that sun can kill him. What's he doing out here? So I walked over and I pat him on the back and say, what are you doing here? And he looked up and he was senile. And I turned to the warden and said, what's he doing here? And why is he out here in the sun? And the answer was, we've been trying to get rid of him for years. But every time we recommend his release, the word comes back from the FBI, he killed an agent. He'll never be released. That kind of vengeance is hardly equal justice under law, and it demeans law enforcement and should never be permitted. I've been in 4 or 5 of the parole hearings for Leonard. One hearing officer couldn't stand it and recommended immediate release. He was removed from his position shortly after that, literally, and was back as a guard. He'd been in the prison, Bureau of Prisons for years, and he started out as a guard, and he was back as a guard because he recommended release of a man who'd been in prison when he shouldn't have been for all those years. The other reason is that Leonard is a real threat to those who want to repress the indigenous people because he's a powerful communicator for Indian peoples. I've watched Indian art for years. I started out in the 50s as a kid. I represented the Western Band of Cherokee, and boy, I was the best client I had in those years. And I've watched all their artists. They've had a lot of great artists. Leonard's a painter, and he's a powerful painter. And he paints what he knows. And his paintings are true. I have the IAC gave it to me, I think I have a large, I don't know if it's a lithograph or what it is, of a painting he did called Big Mountain Lady. And it's this beautiful Indian woman. She's part of a Dinai Navajo tribe. And she wears this purple that they all wear. And she's got streaks of silver in her hair. And if you look at it, there's a tear coming down. And it was an occasion that Leonard had seen himself 8 years earlier. A well-known woman, she was actually back here and in my office one time. She's died more recently. But she was at Big Mountain, which is a religious mountain near Four Corners on the Arizona side. And the U.S. Bureau of Mines had started mining the religious mountain, Big Mountain. And it was the worst type, just earth removal. And she was crying. He's got hundreds of powerful paintings all over the world. Gorbachev has paintings, Ted Turner, there are paintings in Australia. And they don't want him out where the truth of the Indian people can be seen through his... The same thing with Mumia, his writings are powerful, his voice is powerful. You've got to contain it. And why does Stephen Biko get killed? Because he's a threat, because it's like Hawthorne's The Great Stone Mountain, his words have power because they conform to the thoughts and life he's always lived. Leonard's a threat, a beautiful threat of truth about the Indian people, what we've done to them, and what they remain, a people of spirit and future.
Now, I'm trying to group these questions, so you'll have to bear with me. There's actually several cards, several questions asking why you're defending Saddam Hussein, and should he be on trial, and his past crimes, and so asking for an explanation of that. There's a question about John Murdaugh, who some political pundits say speaks for U.S. military generals, has said the majority of troops will be deployed from Iraq by the end of 2006, leaving only 20,000 troops behind. What do you think? And a question of how the Green Zone has managed to remain a, quote, safe place while the insurgency rages outside it.
Don't do too many, because I have trouble forgetting, remember.
All right, I think we'll group the other questions, but I think the first question was on the trial of Saddam Hussein and your role, and then a number of others deal with specifics on Iraq and conditions now. I'll group those together.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find the question, why am I representing him? Why am I one of the lawyers representing him? It's almost too easy to answer. It's what I've always done. I've always opposed the death penalty, for instance. Most people who face executions in this society have had pretty miserable lives, and many of them have made other people's lives pretty miserable, and some of them short. It doesn't mean that they're not entitled to the effective assistance of counsel. Because they're hated, because they're feared, because they've been demonized in the press, if you want truth and justice, someone's got to stand up and fight for them. But I oppose execution in all cases. I think an execution in Saddam Hussein's case would seem to justify the invasion, would, as I said earlier, even more deeply anger millions of people in Iraq, make reconciliation, which is essential, much more difficult. Bush wants it because it tends to validate what he did, you know? And that's a form of sickness that I can hardly stand. Bush never batted an eye with more than 150 executions while he was governor of Texas. More than any governor in our time, and I think any governor in history. And they included women, equal justice under law. They included aliens in violation of the Vienna Convention on diplomatic missions. They included minors in violation of international law. And the one that's hardest for me, because we have a daughter who I love more than anybody on earth and is retarded. He executed retarded people. Well, God help the society that has no better heart than to do that. So, should he be on trial? He shouldn't be on trial unless George Bush is. And a few others. I won't start counting all of them. But, now what's the next question?
There is a trial
going on. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there is a trial going on. Well, I wouldn't say that there's a trial going on, but there's a play act going on. That court has no more independence than a puppet show. The only question is they don't know who's pulling all the strings, because the U.S. pulls strings, and the Shia government pulls strings, and the Kurdish government pulls strings, and even the Iran government pulls a few strings. But the judges are not objective, they're not impartial, and they're not following anything that could be vaguely compared to the rule of law. The court itself is not legal.
Next, there's a series of other questions on Iraq. Maybe we'll deal with this before we deal with the questions on Iran. But even if the U.S. pulls out its active troops in Iraq, what about the huge 14 permanent bases that are being built? A request that you address the issue of the use of white phosphorus and other chemical weapons against civilians in Fallujah. And also, if you have any information on the civilian toll since the U.S. invasion, since the end of sanctions, saying that there were 1.5 million during the years of sanctions, but what about now?
Get me started again. How'd the first one
Okay, so the first one was about the 14 permanent U.S. bases, and then the other about U.S. weapons.
For Murtaugh to say that some general says we're going to get everybody out except 20,000 has no real meaning. It's something that's said to make us go home and watch a sitcom or something instead of being upset. We need to recognize, too, that merely getting out with the troops is not enough by any means. We've done billions of dollars of damage to that country and its people, and we owe reparations. No U.S. company should be permitted to participate in any contract in Iraq, in my opinion. I mean, you go there and it's sick. Guys like to talk, and even the press will talk, say, see that guy over there said he's a billionaire. On what? He's got a contract for doing the Army's laundry. Now, if you're doing the laundry for hundreds of thousands of people every day and charging about three times what you ought to, you're raking in a lot of money. The concessions, and I've been eating in a military mess hall, and the concessions there, the people are getting rich. They initially tried to make us pay $6,000 to be escorted in from the airport to the court and back one time, $6,000, which means that's about what they're paying. And one of the guys who was escorting, he seemed to be a nice guy, he said he's building a big condominium in Beirut. His wife's from the Middle East. That means he's made a pile of money, you know. And he's going to retire on the money he makes there. We need to get out. We need to liberate Iraq from all the concessions that have been made. We've already tied up their oil, you know. Not only the producing oil, which U.S. and British companies have the major concessions on in the future, but the non-productive lands, where U.S. and British oil companies have tied the lands up for future exploration and production. So our military could withdraw and we could take their oil for the rest of time until it's gone. Of course, the military bases can't remain in U.S. hands and shouldn't remain at all. They ought to be destroyed. But what we've done is things are so divided now that it's kind of like the Indian Wars. With luck, they'll take care of each other and we won't have to worry about them very much anymore.
There's a number of questions dealing with Iran. One, do you think that the invasion of Iran could lead to a world conflict or war, drawing in Russia, China, U.S. allies, its destabilizing capacity? And the other is asking you a question that you said that the U.S. doesn't have the military capacity to invade Iran. Explain that.
Our military is stretched pretty thin, if you haven't noticed. That's a reason that the strategy of not letting recruiters take advantage of young Americans who dream of free college and a good job and a future getting hooked into going to Iraq to get blown up, because they're not able to fill their recruitment needs. That's why it's so dangerous to have NATO troops going into Afghanistan. We really need to resist that in every way we can. That's a continuation of colonial power. Those are colonial countries. Yeah. NATO should be abolished. I said NATO should be abolished in the Cold War. But certainly it ought to be abolished now. And it shouldn't be a surrogate for the United States. The UN shouldn't be a surrogate for the United States either. It's only a figurehead surrogate in a place like Haiti because they've got troops from about 40 countries and they don't control those troops. Each one's controlled from their own country, but they're killing people in the name of the United Nations. And it's just a shameful thing that's happened, but we have enormous coercive power over those things. I hope Kofi Annan, who I believe is a good man, will see that and change and get out of there. Iran is about four times now the population of Iraq. It hasn't been debilitated. It hadn't been under sanctions. It doesn't have a stunted generation. Anybody who saw young teenage Iranians charging deadly fire against Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war with nothing but a pair of tennis shoes and a pair of pants and a rifle and going against long-range artillery and short-range artillery and mortars and armored vehicles and massive firepower, and boy, if they got near you, you were finished. And they lost about 800,000 kids, 13, 14 years and up. Iraq lost about 250,000, one of the most tragic and senseless wars. I don't think the military would let Bush try to invade. I don't think he could. I think the repercussions of an attack on Iran in Iraq would be enormous, because I think he would motivate Muslims and others from all over the world going there and trying to drive the United States out. But they're going to have to feel they can do something, and you see both sides. One of these sad things happened in life. A lawyer, a good friend of mine from California, who I've represented on several problems he had, he was so proud of Dianne Feinstein in the Alito hearings. He said she asked tough questions. Already, she said, shouldn't be a filibuster. But worse than that, she said as to Iran, said we simply cannot, we must not let them continue development of their nuclear plants. So you got this Congress afraid to stand up, and they'll try their best to find something to do. And I think the risk of missile attacks, or maybe they use these new drone things they have, whatever's easiest and cheapest, the missiles are expensive, to take the plants out. But I'll tell you this, the symbolism of it is that we use our military to just beat up on defenseless people. And I think the world's pretty fed up with that right now. Ought to be. We should too. That's why we need to impeach.
There's a lot more questions on impeachment and the campaign for impeachment and different strategies for impeachment. Some involve the idea of appointing a special prosecutor. Could Bush be prosecuted at the International Criminal Court? A number of strategies about how to launch this and make it a larger campaign.
You know, I don't mind special prosecutors, but the idea that they're a substitute for impeachment is a profound misunderstanding. They can prosecute for crimes. You can't prosecute a sitting president. You have to wait till he gets out. But if you want to address the real problem is the constitutional failure to do our duty under the impeachment clause, which says the president, vice president, other civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office upon impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors. That's what it says, shall. And that's what we have to do. That's the way that you cure the problem. That's the way you tell the next ones that the same thing will happen to you, because we mean it. And this isn't a one-time thing. It's not a political thing. We, the people, simply aren't going to stand. So the sole power of impeachment, as I said earlier, is in the Congress. It starts in the judiciary. Most recent impeachment things have been bad jokes. I represented William O. Douglas back in 1970 when he was being impeached. Gerald Ford introduced the resolution. He had 26 Republicans against a sitting justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. One of the grounds was that he had voted against certiorari to review acquittal as a matter of law of a theater that had shown a movie called I Am Curious Yellow. And they had asked Douglas if he had seen the movie. And he said, no. They said, well, how can you vote on it? He said, I read the Constitution. Says the Congress will make no law abridging freedom of speech. It's freedom of speech. That's the answer to Larry's question about whether we can get an injunction against demagogues going out saying how much they love Martin Luther King Jr. on his birthday. They got a right to say it. We just have enough common sense to know that they're demagogues, you know, and hypocrites. Thank you, Bear Gill.
Yeah, we can't go past 9 o'clock, so I've got to go right now. Okay, all right. Thank you, Ramsey.
I've got dinner with people. I promised earlier. Wonderful to be with you. Thanks so much.